exciting, controversial subject to the other. No let up. And we're going to turn the issue over to really much of what was really behind much of the first set of discussion, which is where we're going on Medicare and what should we do about it. It is true that when I started this conference, this was an intellectual discussion. For me now, it's very real, since Medicare is my my preferred provider. So I'm going to turn the program over to Liz Fowler, who will then direct this section. Liz?
Great. Thank you so much, Stu, and I'm really pleased to be here. In the past couple of years, Congress and the administration have dipped a toe back into the water of Medicare reform as part of overall deficit reduction, thinking about a grand bargain. I think that sentiment has waned somewhat with a more recent focus on tax reform rather than entitlement reform. Many argue that entitlement reform is still desperately needed to head off an impending fiscal crisis, or maybe David Cutler would say, it doesn't ruin the economy. Others point to historic lows in spending growth and believe that the crisis has passed to some degree, and that a lot of the ACA payment reforms and delivery reforms need to be allowed to work, give them a little bit more time to work. What's clear from the last and relatively short-lived debate over Medicare reform on the Hill is that there really wasn't a consensus on what reform means. The Bipartisan Policy Center has a recent proposal on the latest Bowles-Simpson plan, have reignited some interest in finding common ground on Medicare, but really to a limited degree. This panel is going to explore these themes and more. I'm going to introduce our panel members, and we'll start from the far right, not necessarily in order of political views, but everyone's to my right. So starting with Rick Foster, up until February 1st of this year, Rick was chief actuary for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, a position he held since February 1995. As all of you know here, CMS's Office of the Actuary is responsible for all the actuarial and financial analyses, both retrospective and prospective, for Medicare and Medicaid, which represents 45% of all healthcare spending. In that role, OACT is also involved in estimating financial impacts of legislative proposals, for preparing national health expenditure data and the projections, for producing the Medicare economic index, the hospital input price index, and other price indices used to update Medicare payments to providers. OACT is also involved in calculating the MA benchmarks for private health plans and also for reviewing bids for all MA and Part D plans. Prior to his role at CMS, Rick was deputy chief actuary at Social Security Administration for 13 years. He has a master's in applied mathematics from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and a bachelor's from the College of Worcester. Rick has received countless awards throughout his career and was identified by Modern Healthcare as one of the most 100 influential persons in healthcare in the U.S. for 5 years in a row. Perhaps most importantly, and hopefully without revealing too much information, Rick is close to turning 65 and becoming eligible for Medicare, so he has a very personal stake in this debate. Mark Miller is Executive Director of MedPAC, the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission, the nonpartisan federal agency that advises Congress on Medicare payments, quality and access issues. Mark has over 20 years of health policy experience, including senior positions and leadership positions at CBO, Congressional Budget Office, at CMS, and at OMB. Mark has a PhD in public policy from the State University of New York at Binghamton. The third panelist is Stuart Butler. Since August 2010, Stuart Butler has served as the director for the Center for Policy Innovation, or CPI, at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative DC-based think tank. The CPI has been described as a think tank within a think tank, or as the Heritage president has described it, a freewheeling research laboratory dedicated to thinking outside the box to devise landmark policy recommendations consonant with time-tested conservative principles. In other words, he's given the issues that we're going to talk about today a lot of thought. Prior to this role, Stewart guided Heritage's domestic policy agenda for almost 30 years, where he helped shape the debate on critical issues from healthcare to Social Security to welfare reform and tax relief. The National Journal has referred to Stewart as one of Washington's 12 key players on healthcare. He's published articles in many leading newspapers and academic journals. He's also edited several books and is the author of three, testified before Congress, and appeared as a guest commentator on most all of the major television networks. Stewart was raised in England and moved to the United States in 1975. He holds a bachelor's degree in physics and mathematics, a master's degree in economics, and a doctorate in American economic history from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. So I'm going to leave it there and turn it over to the panel members to give a presentation. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm really pleased to have the opportunity and the time, finally, to join with so many distinguished experts and to discuss healthcare policy. I'm going to talk about three issues. The first is, when you think about addressing Medicare's challenges, it's very important to know which challenge is which and to keep them straight. The second is that the financial challenges facing the program are probably a good bit worse than those suggested by the projections shown under current law. The third item is that while everybody agrees about the importance of reducing healthcare cost growth rates, most of the proposals out there don't actually do that. Only a few have that impact. Okay, so on that optimistic note, what's the difference between Medicare solvency, which in fact this panel is all about, or Medicare's impact on the federal budget, or on Medicare's long-range sustainability? Well, the solvency of Medicare really has to do with the financial status of each of the individual trust fund accounts. And in particular, is a fund's income enough to cover the fund's expenditures? So that's a basic question of financial balance. That's solvency. Now, the budget impact is entirely different. That has to do with whether Medicare adds to or subtracts from the overall national federal budget deficit. Then if you talk about sustainability, this is broader yet and much more difficult to talk about than the first two. And it's not only an issue of financial sustainability in the long range, it's an important question of, can the Medicare program do what it's designed and intended to do? Now, these concepts, I've noticed, have been confused constantly. It happens all the time. They're fundamentally different concepts, yet they're used interchangeably. But any information about one concept can't really be used necessarily to talk about or answer questions for another concept. So that's why it's important to keep in mind, what are we actually talking about? Let's first talk about the financial status of the Medicare program, and you have to do this by trust fund account. This chart compares, in the long range, income to the hospital insurance or Part A trust fund for Medicare, and that's the bottom curve shown, the income rate, expressed as a percentage of taxable payroll. And you can notice that the income rate increases over time relative to taxable payroll, and that's because you know the new additional 0.9% Part A payroll tax rate for high-income workers. Well, you define high income by certain income thresholds, earnings thresholds, and they're fixed. They're frozen. They'll never change under current law. So over time, more and more workers, in fact, the great majority of workers, will become, quote, high-income workers. And that means more and more pay the 0.9% additional tax, and the income rate goes up. Now, under current law, you can see the middle projection, the middle curve, which is the projected expenditures of the program under current law. And under current law, the scheduled income to the program would be sufficient to cover roughly two-thirds of the long-range cost of the program. Obviously, that's not enough for the program to work financially. Now, I've thrown a third curve on here. We'll talk about that more in a minute. But if certain elements of current law don't function can't be sustained, then the actual cost for Part A of Medicare could be quite a bit higher. And if that happens, in fact, the cost would it would continue to increase pretty much steadily and indefinitely. And ultimately, the scheduled income to the program would cover only about 40% of the projected cost. So under pretty much any conclusion, the Part A of Medicare is not adequately financed. It's not in financial balance. Now, there's also Part B and there's Part D. Part C, Medicare Advantage, you know, is paid out of Part A and B. But Parts B and D are automatically in financial balance. That's because the financing for the program from beneficiary premiums and from federal general revenues, that's reset every year to match expected cost. So the program's automatically in financial balance when you take into account all of the scheduled revenues. This concept of financial status is important, but it's also narrowly focused. It's not the only way to talk about Medicare and its financial aspects. And note that the financial status of Medicare tells you nothing about the program's impact on the budget, absolutely nothing. So let's talk about the impact on the budget for a moment. This chart takes the major sources of revenue for Medicare and adds those up. Starting at the bottom, we have the Part A payroll taxes. Then we have income taxes on Social Security benefits that are allocated to Part A. Then beneficiary premiums. A little bit of revenue from state transfers to Part D and the drug fees on manufacturers and importers of brand name drugs, which are allocated to Part B. Then we have a large amount of general revenue transfers that are provided for by the law, mostly to help finance major parts of Part B and Part D. Now, those all added up still are not as much as the total level of expenditures. And let's focus on the general revenues just for a moment. For determining the financial status of Medicare and the individual trust fund accounts, we count those general revenues because it is a statutory source of financing for the program. However, when we look at the budget, it's an intergovernmental transfer. General revenues from one pocket to another don't represent a source of dedicated revenue from outside the government. It's an internal transfer. So you can't count that as revenue for a budget determination. As a result, if you look at the difference between total expenditures and total revenues, then you get essentially what's defined as the trust fund deficit. However, if you look at the difference between total expenditures and total dedicated revenues, which excludes the general fund transfers, then you get the impact of Medicare on the federal budget deficit. This chart just looks historically at both of these perspectives, at the difference between total Medicare income and total Medicare expenditures. On a trust fund perspective, you can see that the difference has been pretty close to zero over time. Not exactly, but pretty close to zero, because if it weren't, either the trust fund would go broke or it would balloon into astronomical levels. So over time, adjustments have been made to keep the trust fund balances pretty close to even. Now, in contrast, under the budget perspective, where we have a lot of general revenue financing, which doesn't count as revenues for a budget purpose, then you can see that Medicare has contributed to the federal budget deficit for many, many years. And in fact, that's grown over time as Part B expenditures have increased significantly, and also as Part D was added in 2006. I need a joke in here somewhere. You know, I listened to David Cutler and I listened to Bob Reichar, and this is great, you know. And I'll just say that I'm actually pretty optimistic about the future. But I don't feel my optimism is justified. Okay, what is this? To my way of thinking, this is bad news. Now, a lot of you maybe don't think it's so bad, but let's talk about what it is. There are certain elements of current law that I think are likely not to be sustainable. We'll get to the sustainable growth rate mechanism in a moment for physician payments, But let's start with the product